This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can also be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Chris Moore, and today we'll talk with conductor Robert Spano about conducting and his gentle advice for how audiences can best enjoy the music they hear. Then we'll talk with Alan Fletcher about his newest composition, and finally cellist András Fejér about the upcoming Takács Quartet concerts. Let's begin with my chat with Robert Spano. Robert, I know you just got out of the conducting orchestra and working with the conductors, and I know that's one of your great loves here. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that because it's actually one of my favorite concerts every Tuesday afternoon. Can you tell us about these students, how you find them, and how you work with them?
Well, the American Academy of Conducting at Aspen, which we call ACA most of the time, is one of the most extraordinary conducting programs I've ever seen anywhere, in that the students who come here as conductors play in their own orchestra. And what it means is that they have all summer their own orchestra with which they perform concerts every Tuesday, and they also read a great deal of other repertoire along the way. So they're really in the thick of it all the time. That laboratory is one of the most effective ways to learn. I remember my teacher, Max Rudolph, saying the best way to learn to conduct is to conduct. And the next best way is to observe, and the third best way is to have a teacher. So it's the ideal circumstance, really, for those that come. It's an astonishingly difficult program to get into, in that I watch almost 200 tapes every year, and we take between 12 and 16 conductors at a time. So it's quite a competitive field for those students to come here.
I know David Zinman founded this program, and you've taken it over, and I know it's one of your favorites. I wonder if you ever sometimes wish, like, oh, I wish I had had that when I was a young guy.
Oh, absolutely. And what David did, the legacy he left by creating this program is extraordinary. He modeled it in many ways on the Montreux School, where he had studied in Maine, which had a similar system where the conductors also played in the orchestra. In many ways, we're still very close to the Montreux School model, but with some variations.
When I go to hear something really major like a Mahler symphony being done, first of all, I think these young conductors are so lucky because it's always the principal conductors that get the big gigs like Mahler. And they get to do that when they're 22 years old or something, which is unusual. The other thing that surprises me is that there appears to be an overarching interpretation where the first, second, third, and fourth, and maybe even fifth movements seem to be conducted by almost the same person. Do you make that one of the goals, is to have a kind of a unity of interpretation, or am I just hearing something that's not really there?
Well, I think there are times when what you say is absolutely the case, and I think it happens because they're in communication with each other. But other times I've witnessed the concerts where within a given symphony the different movements sound like different composers almost because they didn't share those points of view. And I try and be sure that there's always a fine line between individuality and wrong. And I try and make sure I'm always respecting individuality and trying to discern where that line is so that I can also prevent wrong.
I can imagine. I know one time I heard you recommend a book. I don't remember what it was even. It was a few years ago. I loved it. And I'm wondering if there's a book you've read recently that you would love our listeners to pick up, or something you might want to share.
Yeah, for the past few years, I had recommended a book festival-wide every summer. I didn't do that this summer, not by design, but just by neglect, I think. I chose the books in the past so carefully, in a way, because they were things that had stuck out in my – I'm an avid reader, and they had stuck out in my year. I think it was last year that it was The Way of Beauty.
Yes.
Which
yes,
was Francois Cheng. Those were such incredibly elegant essays on
– I would call them meditations, actually.
And he did. You're right. He called them Five Meditations on Beauty. I guess if there's any book that's closest to my mind at the moment, it's Time and the Soul by Jacob Needleman, because I was rereading it. I read it many years ago, and I was rereading it on a recent trip to Singapore. There's time on the plane to read. I love his thoughtfulness around the sense that many of us have that we're always in a hurry, and perhaps there's another way to get through the day and to have time where we can reflect, or even within our hectic schedules to feel less hurried and hectic.
I actually wanted to ask you about that too, because I know, for example, Alan Fletcher goes up to Maine and he retreats and he composes for maybe 2 or 3 months. Do you have time when you're able to also be quiet? Because here you are as the principal conductor of one of the busiest festivals I imagine in the world.
I try. perhaps the most rewarding time that I've had sort of in retreat from the world has been in the last few years at the Hermitage in Monosota Key, Florida, where they invite artists to come for a period of time. And I was astonished how much I could get done when I was doing nothing but writing music 12 hours a day. And I didn't have a television, and I wasn't using my phone very often, and no radio, no computer. So there was something really spectacular about composing music for 2 weeks on the Gulf of Mexico.
I know that as a principal conductor of the Aspen Music Festival and school, you have to be sure that the brass players are taken care of. But it sounds to me as though there are other reasons to bring in the composers of the really big works, Mahler being one of them, of course. Not just because we have to bring in the brass.
It is a wonderful thing for the brass to play Mahler, that's for sure. But you're right, even apart from that, it's repertoire that's so compelling and a passion of many of us at the festival, audience, donors, board members, musicians, faculty alike, that I think that's the reason we continue to enjoy having a good representation of Mahler.
I'd like to ask about Aida, which is one of the major, major centerpieces of this season. You have experience now, having conducted Mahler's Eighth Symphony, two seasons ago or so, of working with very large ensemble and people, you know, scattered all over the place and somehow bringing it all together and holding it together. It seems like you're facing the exact same challenge again with Verdi's Aida, and yet at the same time, there's amazing intimacy in that work sometimes, like the way it ends. Can you tell us a little bit about the preparation and some of the challenges that you're going to have as a conductor holding this massive work together?
Well, I think one of the most exciting things for me about the Aida project this summer is continuing opera in the tent, as we did with Peter Grimes, where whether we say it's semi-staged or theatrical presentation, it really ends up being an opera production.
Yes.
And to do that in the tent is a challenge, but a great one and a great. We had such a great reward in the experience we had with the Grimes, with the effectiveness of what can be done in the tent, even though it wasn't designed with that in mind. I think Ed Berkeley's imagination about what can be done in the tent is extraordinary, and to have that this summer following up on our previous opera in the tent, I'm very excited.
This may sound almost silly, but do you have advice for your audiences here in Aspen? When I talked to Alan Fletcher, he talked about just how attentive the audience is and how committed the audience is. But I wonder if you have any thoughts you may want to share with an audience who's coming, and what to expect or what state to be in as they plop in their seats and surrender themselves to whoever's conducting tonight's concert.
I guess my first reaction is that when I hear comments from people, as one does from time to time, about feeling insecure about their perceptions of classical music or feeling maybe uncomfortable about their knowledge level, I always am concerned at hearing that, because in my mind, this art is available to anyone with an open mind and open ears. And any experience one has in response to it is valid. There isn't a right way to hear a piece of music. There are as many ways to hear a piece of music as there are those of us who are listening. And it is true that as you explore more the classical repertoire and the canon, that one's experience of it can be enhanced with all kinds of extra musical knowledge, or even just more musical experience and more listening experience. But I think the initial and certainly most important part of listening throughout a lifetime is knowing that there's no right way to experience a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's welcome. And any piece of music is for anyone who cares to attend to it.
Robert, thank you so much. It was an honor to have a few minutes with you before the day before the season begins.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you.
It's a joy.
Thank you so much.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Chris Moore, and I've been interviewing conductor and Aspen Music Festival and School Music Director Robert Spano. On a winter's night, a traveler, a silent film by Bill Morrison with original music by Alan Fletcher, premieres this Friday evening. I caught up with Alan last week to talk about the project. Alan, last year here at the Aspen Music Festival, we saw a very moving film by Bill Morrison called The Flood, and it looks like another movie is on the agenda for early July with your music. Can you tell us a little bit about how you and Bill Morrison, the film director, got together to produce this product?
Sure. Well, we loved the project last summer with The Flood, and that was with jazz musician Bill Frisell. So came up with the idea of commissioning a work, and then it was Asador Centurion and Robert Spano's idea that I would write the work. So this is about a 15-minute long tone poem for orchestra. Bill and I then met actually late last summer to discuss the project and my suggestion that we both work from a wonderful novel by Italo Calvino, a very important Italian novelist. The novel is called If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler. And it turned out Bill loves that novel and was very familiar with it. I set off and wrote the piece, made a synthesized version of it, so it sounds sort of like what it'll sound like.
Right.
Sent that off to Bill, and then he made his artwork, which is absolutely beautiful. He and I have not even spoken about it. He just sent me a copy of it.
Is it almost like a silent film with a score, or is there other people talking in this film this time?
There's no talking. It is silent. I think most of it is old footage, like apparently from the 1920s. A lot of it looks Italian to me, although I'm not sure if that's what it is. It has sort of a storyline, or several storylines, which is appropriate for the Calvino novel, which is all about multiple storylines. I think it fits the music absolutely beautifully. I see a connection to the work of Ken Burns in that it's more or less a collage of existing elements. Mm-hmm. That is, no new footage was shot for this project, and it is silent.
You simply gave him the score, and you both, of course, knew and loved the novel. And then from there, he just found images that go with it. So in a sense, you were the one that the starter. That you, a lot of times when you do film scores, it's quite the opposite. They come, they say, here's the movie, you've got 3 weeks, compose. How did you have such good fortune to actually be able to have your music be chronologically the first thing that took place?
Well, it is fortunate, I think, and I've done some film scoring for documentary films myself, so I know how that goes. I would say in this case it's more that two simultaneous artworks inspired by the novel coexist. It's interesting that sometimes things in Bill's work are very precisely synchronized with the music, and sometimes they're not. With good effect, I think, in both ways.
Thank you. Now let's talk with cellist András Fejér about the Takács Quartet recitals coming up July 8th and 11th. You have two concerts coming up, one on the 8th and one on the 11th of July. And before I get to that, I wonder if you are a part of the string quartet program. The training program here is rather extraordinary, and I think you're a part of that, aren't you?
Absolutely. We are happily coaching the fantastic young quartets preformed, looking forward to some more teaching.
What is it that you feel makes a quartet successful, besides there's the obvious technical requirements, they have to get up to a certain skill level, but beyond that, I mean, if they're competent.
hard work and the ability to stay together.
Right.
It's probably the two basics. Everything else is optional.
I would think so. Tell us a little bit about the music you're playing. One of them is a work you're extremely familiar with and have actually, the quartet itself has kind of taught audiences, and that's the Opus 59, number 1 of Beethoven. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what to expect. I believe that's on the 8th of July, that particular performance.
We adore that piece. The first quartet from Beethoven's middle period, and in scope, just such symphonic, huge sound and structure and length, actually. As a highly biased cellist, I need to mention that this is the only quartet Beethoven must have been experimented, which practically all four movements starts with the cello.
Mm-hmm. Now, which makes it by far the greatest quartet ever written.
No, I wouldn't go that far, because then my credibility would be in question. But it's interesting that after all, he already wrote the Opus 18s, six quartets, so he had some ideas about possibilities, giving certain instruments certain leads. So he must have been experimenting, and it's a great sorrow for me personally that right after this quartet, he just dumped the whole experiment. It never ever happened again that the cello gets such a prominent role at the beginnings of all movements.
Just as a listener, I was aware, of course, of the gorgeous cello melody that starts the whole piece, but then after that, I see you just kind of weaving into the fabric with everybody else.
Yeah, so it would have been fascinating to know his thought process, to learn about his thought process and why he ultimately chucked the whole idea.
This one also has a wonderful finale to it that's full of vibrancy and energy. And we think of Beethoven as a very serious composer and of the string quartets as very serious works. But I find sometimes that there's just so much joy in some of these quartets, as we can hear in Opus 59, number 1, that last movement.
The last movement theme is where he pays homage to his patron, Count Ambassador Razumovsky, and quotes a Russian folk song, and he makes it a very cheerful intro, and in every way but the very last moment, which used to be in the original Russian a very sad lament, mm-hmm, of some poor soldiers coming home from the Napoleonic War. So Ed discovered this during his research, and it's half tempo, it's very elegiac, very wistful. The poor soldier can hardly survive, yet Beethoven starts it as a jolly up sort of song.
The Takács Quartet, I'm very familiar with your programming in Boulder, because you have a whole series there in Boulder, Colorado, and you tend to love to play the greatest, the best known, not exclusively, but I would say that your your choice of repertoire is certainly not like, say, the Kronos Quartet or a Turtle Island String Quartet or anybody like that. When you are playing these works that are very familiar to well-known, you know, to audiences who know chamber music and to all of you, you say you're still arguing about how to make it better. Can you tell us a little bit about how you keep the freshness when you're playing these absolute masterpieces of the standard repertoire?
Well, you have to keep the freshness, otherwise we would just be like a stew, not allowing outside ingredients and fresh ideas to seep in. As I said, we are just about in our 40th seasons, and thank God we feel spoiled, because these pieces are so deep, so detailed, that basically even today we feel we could argue about them for a couple of more decades.
Now, I know your violist came in, what was it, 8 or 10 years ago?
10 years ago.
Years ago. And did that change the overall sound or the overall energy, I guess you might say, of the Takash to bring a new player in after all those years?
Well, something always changes when there's a new member. But since we always talk about expressivity and character, the new player also starts thinking along those lines. And of course, we sound different, but I hope that the overall effect, what we're projecting to the audience, is similar to what it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, as an audience member, I can say yes, that the transition was a very subtle one, especially after about the first year. And when the ensemble was fully back together again, it sounded almost indistinguishable to me, which is amazing. Because we have a very different personality, very different, everybody's different.
No, we should have different personalities.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it would be hell.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Sometimes you or Ed or some other people just are also have a great sense of humor, even though, again, when you think of chamber music, you think of the string quartet as the sanctum sanctorum of chamber music or something like that. And it certainly is, you take it very seriously in the work that you do. But at the same time, I think all of you really do have a wonderful sense of humor that comes out in some of your liner notes, you might say.
No, the work and the closed togetherness, what we've been doing in the last decades, I mean, there needs to be a discharge, there needs to be a release, there needs to be something which balances all these supposed seriousness. Mm-hmm. So many times, and one feels the pressure at the concert hall, high risk venues all over the world. Mm-hmm. So it's natural that once we are out of the dressing rooms and back on the streets, we just try to giggle as much as anyone.
I'm almost afraid to go backstage with you and ask you if you could share some of the... Do you pull pranks on each other? Do you just tell jokes about the people in the front row in the audience?
No, not the people. You know, first of all, one, just like a chess player or a top sportsman or sportswoman, we remember every single concert, what happened individually and together. And to think back, to hash up those happenings, that's always a wonderful way to release tension or get giddy and lighthearted. So we can find enough things to tease within ourselves,
right?
Without any need to go outside.
Now, I know some of the well-known soloists, especially, have to travel, it seems, all year, all the time. And you do a fair amount of traveling, but it seems that you have your anchor at Boulder, at CU Boulder. Does that seem to be about the right balance between having a life at home and having a life on the road, so that neither one is either boring or completely exhausting?
In the first 20 years, while we became or trying to become known, we had to travel wild. I'm talking about 9, 10, there was 1 year, even 11 months out of the year. Since Edward joined, we try to be more reasonable and sensible. So now we cut it back to 5 months mm-hmm. already, which is a great luxury for a traveling string quartet, and spend the time in Boulder, which is a wonderful place, and the university really just goes out of its way to accommodate what we need.
So your concert on the 8th is entirely the Takash Quartet, and the concert on the 11th is with collaborators. You have an extra string player for the Mozart, and you have a pianist for the Franck Piano Quintet. I'll never forget one time, actually, the members of the Emerson Quartet were walking madly backstage, and they had some kind of piano quintet, and they said, "So much music, so little rehearsal time. Do you think you'll have enough time? Do you have it scheduled to be able to rehearse with your two collaborators that are
Yes,
coming in?"
We take it very seriously, so mm-hmm. that the audience should never feel that it's just an ad hoc ensemble. If necessary, we arrive a day or two earlier, just so mm-hmm. everybody could get familiar, although we already played with both James and Anton many times before.
Right, right.
But the audience deserves production where, if they wish, they can relax and lean back and not crossing fingers so that the ensemble could keep up with each other.
Well, it's not us that's crossing fingers, you know, it's you guys. so anyway, that's great to know. And when you come to a place like Aspen and you collaborate, is that something where you go to Asador or somebody and ask, you say, "Here are some of the musicians that we really enjoy working with," or do they suggest musicians to you to collaborate?
It's a give and take mm-hmm. process. We suggest something, Asador suggests something else, and then we come to an understanding. But so far, there's never been troublesome, because whenever he just flicks an eyebrow, we just know, okay, mm-hmm. he needs something else.
Cellist András Fejér, a member of the Takash Quartet, talking about the two recitals coming up July 8th and 11th with the Takash Quartet. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and previews upcoming performances. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 and Saturdays at 3 for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.